oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who's Dean of the Graduate School of Education. I should mention that this is during the time of COVID-19, so we are not physically together in the studio. We are all in our respective homes coming at you by Zoom today, and our guest will be presenting by Zoom as well.
Well, Dr. Denise Mental Melt Pope.
Mental melt?
I don't know. I was struggling there. I want to talk a little about this idea of summer learning loss, or sometimes it's called summer melt or summer slide. So I didn't mean to imply that your brain is melting in case you took offense.
Although it kind of is, you know, COVID, summer, heat wave, it's kind of melting. It is. What you want to talk about summer learning loss? Are you a believer in this, Dan?
I think it probably indexes something, but I think people make too much of it. So for example, there was a report that came out that over summer, your learning drops by about 1 to 2 months in reading and about 1 to 3 months for math. And so this is, at the face of it, this is kind of a horrifying statistic. You know, I have not done math for 40 years. The amount of math I have forgotten is I'm negative a fetus, right? It's sort of like you just keep losing and losing. And So I get it, but it sort of doesn't fit with learning theory very well. So you know, like riding a bike, you maybe forget how to do it, but once you get on, you remember really quickly, right? And okay. So this is kind of a known thing, that the fact that you take a test and you look like you're 2 months earlier doesn't mean it's going to take you 2 months to regain that performance. It probably takes a matter of, you know, a couple of hours. And there's all sorts of research on this. One of my favorite studies, actually, long ago, this guy took 5-year-olds and he taught them to read a Greek passage. And they didn't understand Greek. He just taught them to say the sounds and the words, right, at 5. And they all memorized it. And then he came back about 10 years later and he taught them the Greek passage again, versus another group of kids who'd never memorized the Greek passage to start with. And these kids, you know, these kindergartners, they had no memory of studying Greek, yet they were able to learn the Greek passage twice as fast the second time because they had this prior exposure to it.
Wow. Now, right. Okay, wait, don't you think that has to do with the language? It's the language learning? You're supposed to learn language earlier and it's cemented in their brain or something?
It's not like these kids were learning. They weren't learning Greek. I mean, they never learned to translate the Greek passage. They were learning a bunch of arbitrary random sounds and to them. Mm-hmm. So you see this in everything, right? When kids switch from addition to multiplication, their ability to do addition problems slows down, right? Because now you see two numbers like 3 and 4 and you immediately go to multiplication instead of addition. If you then up the amount of addition practice, the speed comes right back. And so this happens all the time. You forget stuff. You have a conversation with a friend. You sort of don't remember it. And then they start to tell you about that trip you took. And suddenly you can remember it all in a very quick amount of time. So the summer learning loss, I think people interpret it incorrectly. They say, oh, my God, you know, the kids have lost over 3 months of summer. They lost 3 months of math. Now we're going to have to make the school year 15 months to make up for this.
First of all, you're making a lot of parents very happy because I think with COVID-19, there's a worry that not only is it summer, it's almost double summer, right? Because it's, you know, right, half of March, April, May, half of June. And I think we're hearing a lot of fear on the part of educators and parents about how are they going to catch up? And now they're, you know, we always knew there was this thing called summer slide and now it's COVID-19 slide. And you know, many years ago, I wrote an article for the New York Times. They asked me to talk about summer education and I think that more kids should be in summer school and doing workbooks and work packets, and should teachers be giving homework out over summer? And I said, no, I said, you know, really, there's a lot of other things that they should be doing in the summer that are really great for kids. Summer camps and getting their body in motion and learning new skills and being outside. And I really was not a proponent of giving worksheets over the summer or giving homework over the summer. And half the time, everyone just waits and does everything at the last minute the day before school anyway. So, you know, to your point, that's not really the best way to learn and retain the information, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if you've already learned it once, spending a day remembering it's not a bad thing. The loss of old learning versus the loss of new learning, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're not in school, you're not doing new learning. That probably concerns me more than you having forgotten what you learned earlier. Because it comes back, you know, once you get exposed to it. So we are fortunate to have someone who really has thought about what gaps in education do. We're talking today with Tom Dees, a professor of education at the Stanford Graduate School of Education. He's an economist, and he looks at education challenges through an economic lens. His studies have examined whether school policies and practices are effective in increasing graduation rates, closing achievement gaps, raising grades. Last time we had him on the show, we talked about holding kindergartners back. So a red shirt year, is that a good thing or not? And Tom talked about a study, I believe it was in Denmark, that sort of said this was a good thing. But today we're going to talk about summer melt and perhaps pandemic melt. You know, because kids aren't in school, so do we worry about what the consequences are going to be down the line? So, Tom, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Thank you. So why do we make such a big deal about summer melt or learning loss? Why? Because it's not, as a psychological phenomenon, it's not that significant, but it may be an index of something important.
Right. And you cited some of the most recent evidence suggesting that there's this 1 to 3 month learning loss, and then took us on a sort of thoughtful, fine rant about that, which I appreciate. But I want to land on a point you made that I think is really critical, because I think the point of summer learning loss isn't so much that you lost what you previously learned. It's maybe a foregone opportunity to get into new learning. But also there's an important aside here, because I think a lot of the discussion around summer learning loss started with some very influential studies from a few years ago, situated in small settings in Atlanta and Baltimore, that not only provided leading evidence on summer learning melt, but suggested that there were big gaps in that learning melt by income status. And so it became part of this kind of stylized argument that kind of deflected accountability for student performance away from schools by pointing at the summer learning melt and saying, see, look, the gaps that are growing appear to be growing when the kids are out of school, not when they're in school. Mm. And that got hardened into this kind of stylized fact that shaped a lot of discourse. But the most recent work, and I think some of what you're citing, for example, work by Megan Kufield at Northwest Evaluation Association, has shown that the summer learning melt, as people commonly document it, appears to be a general phenomenon that doesn't vary by income. So that conventional wisdom, I think it's going to be slow to change because there's kind of an inertia there. But that's part of what I think has generated so much enthusiasm around what are the insights and opportunities created by understanding summer learning loss.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Tom Dees about summer learning loss and a little bit of controversy, Tom, huh? Right? There was this idea that, oh, that's something that happens to kids with lower SES, kids in different neighborhoods.
And the theory for that is that they're getting less mathematical content during the summer. Something like that.
That's right. Whereas advantage kids are still having informal learning opportunities that sustain that, you know, that forestall any sort of learning melt during the summer.
And you're saying, looks like this is more across the board. We're not seeing the differences by socioeconomic status.
That's right. I think there are several studies recently that have pointed that out. And part of what they've uncovered, this will really interest the folks who think a lot about the ways in which we do measurement, how measurement can be misleading. Those early studies used tests that weren't meant to be compared over time. that weren't, in the technical term, vertically scaled, and sometimes had switches and test booklets and things of that sort that created the appearance of differential learning melt over the summer that was in fact a measurement artifact.
It's the old measurement problem. It gets you every time. It's not that they're forgetting what they learned. You and Dan both made that claim. It's that maybe they're not learning certain things that could have happened in those months. That's certainly the COVID-19 worry right now. What they should have learned at the end of fourth grade, they didn't. So now what should the fifth grade teacher do?
That's right. That's the big problem. And part of the way in which educators have responded to this challenge in the pre-COVID era, essentially, was to think about summer learning opportunities. I mean, the early evidence of summer learning melt is the stylized result that launched 1,000 programs. There have been multiple studies of different types of structured summer learning opportunities, so much so that there have been two quantitative meta-analyses, attempts to aggregate all these results into some sort of summative finding. And generally, these studies have found only fairly modest achievement gains associated with these programs, and no gains on the measures of student engagement that we think are important antecedents to longer run student success. So that was sort of a point of departure for some new work that I've been doing with San Francisco Unified, because the program they've been using is different in ways that I think are really informative.
Tell us about the study.
So to set the stage here, we've got summer learning melt. We've got standard programs that typically will bring kids in 5 days a week for partial or full day, with a lot of intensive academic instruction, often in one, maybe at best two subjects, and no other kind of elements to the curriculum. So very narrow, intensive academic instruction, the kind of thing that would probably make your skin crawl, Denise, because there are very few whole child elements to it, not necessarily elements of play and things of that sort.
It's like test prep?
It has a little bit of that feel, instruction and drill.
It also has a negative connotation. You have to go to summer school. It's not, no one goes, yay, I get to go to summer school, right? Somehow it has this.
I did.
You, okay, Dan, you're weird.
Well, no, because when I went to summer school, that's when they did driver training. I took driver training in summer school.
All right, as a big kid.
You look forward to that. Yeah, you look forward to that.
Most people do not look forward to summer school. It sounds like a drag. And for many kids, it is a drag.
Okay, but what San Francisco has been doing is somewhat different. For about 20 years or so, they've partnered with a nonprofit called Aim High. And so Aim High is now running this fairly mature program there. It serves about 1,000 kids every summer across 8 sites. And it's targeted specifically to rising middle school students, so students the summer before they enter 6th grade, and serves them all the way through the summer after 8th grade before they then transition to high school.
That's a good window to work on. Right.
Exactly. That's one thing I like to stress is the targeting, because what we know from some of the recent research on summer learning melt is that that's where that slide, temporary though it may be, Dan, appears to be largest.
Well, sorry, it's not a mental slide. It's puberty.
Yeah, it's puberty. I'm with you. Hey, this is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Tom D about kids who are participating in a kind of a cool sounding program right before they start 6th grade and all the way through 8th grade. Tom, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the program?
Yes, I was mentioning the middle school targeting of it, which I think is propitious. But the other key dimensions are, one is it has a multi-subject focus. It's not just math, not just reading, but it's math, science, and humanities. And critically, it has a strong project-based learning component. It's not necessarily as sort of, you know, direct classroom instruction. They try to engage students and make them active. But another really critical component in its most recent iteration, the summer program includes a very explicit social-emotional curriculum called Issues and Choices that engages kids in thinking about their identity, strategies for preventing bullying, things of that sort. That is really, I think it's really quite novel in the sort of universe of summer learning programs. And that colored our kind of evaluative lens. I, along with some researchers at our John Gardner Center for Youth and Their Communities, partnered with SFUSD and AIM High to study the impact of this program. And we were able to take sort of rich longitudinal data on students, how they were doing in elementary school before some of them began to take up the AIM High program, as well as how they did afterwards. And implement what, you know, I wonkily refer to as a quasi-experimental design, a way of leveraging those kind of rich data to get credibly what's the causal impact of participating in this program. And what we saw were really marked improvements in key proxies for social-emotional measurement. It might be useful to step back here a moment, too, and say we're in a unique moment in how we think about performance metrics for schools. You know, after No Child Left Behind, everything was just about narrow proficiency scores on reading and math tests. But in more recent iterations, we're looking at growth measures, and we're looking to other measures of student engagement, so-called social-emotional measures. But we're very much at a 1.0 moment there. Right? So, survey measures don't seem very reliable. So we look to things like chronic absenteeism and suspension and, you know, clear indicators of students' behavioral engagement in schools.
So hang on. I don't want to take too much of a derail from the line on what this study found. So when I look at chronic absenteeism, for example, as a proxy for social-emotional, isn't it going to be highly correlated with their achievement scores? Like, even though we're measuring something different, there's just these strong correlations across all these things. So the conclusion isn't, we need to focus more on math. The conclusion is we need to focus more on everything, even if we just happen to use a measure of math that shows they're not performing well.
Yeah, I would fully expect them to be correlated. And I think the logic here now of sort of performance measurement for schools is, there are all kinds of reasons we don't want to focus on one measure. Any one measure is going to have limitations, and the focus on any one measure is going to lead to a process of gaming. So the idea now is to have a rich set of measures, some of which overlap. But I think I would particularly underscore for social emotional measurement, because we don't know how to get at sort of the more refined psychological measures of what's going on between students' ears, how they're engaged or enthusiastic about their learning. We're moving towards, at least in this early stage, towards these crude indicators. And we see this under the current version of No Child Left Behind, ESSA. States are responding by focusing on chronic absenteeism.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are going to have more with Tom Dee talking about kind of innovative program in San Francisco taking place over the summer, and particularly what kind of things we can do with kids to get them either back up to speed or prevent some of the potential loss that they may have been exposed to over during the COVID-19 months away from school. We'll be back with more on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Tom Dee, a professor of education at Stanford, about a really innovative summer program that he studied that was going on in San Francisco.
So, Tom, you've explained that they cover lots of courses. They do project-based. They do social-emotional. It sounds like what school should be, the way you've described it. And then you were just talking about some of the measures they're using to try and capture the benefits of this. So what were the results?
Well, the key findings were that we found that participation in the summer program reduce the unexcused absence rate, the prevalence of chronic absenteeism, and of school suspensions over subsequent years.
Wow, that's really interesting. Did it decrease You know, like after the first year, it went down 5%, and then the next year it went down another 10%, or?
Yeah, that was one of the novel things that we tried to dig into in this study, because typically studies have only looked at what's the immediate impact in the summer after the program. But because we had access to San Francisco's longitudinal data on students, we could follow them for at least a couple of years, and we saw some interesting dynamic patterns. There was a modest early effect, but it seemed to grow both with time and with additional summers of participation. And I should note that the Aim High program explicitly builds in a kind of vertical scaffolding of its curriculum, where the things they teach in one summer are meant to connect with subsequent summers. So this often comes up in education research, where we study an innovation. There may not be an immediate impact, but there's often a longer-term impact. And I think this dovetails with how some psychologists talk about child development as having these kind of recursive properties, where students, if they're properly supported, can get into a kind of virtuous cycle where engagement and enthusiasm and achievement builds on itself and amplifies the effect of a positive bit of early support. Yeah.
No, it's a very optimistic view of what you can do.
Engagement is contagious.
You need to maintain an environment where this recursive process can take place.
And I think that's the key to understanding the replication crisis among psychology studies and education. Yeah. Some people find slight little nudge-like interventions build on themselves with positive long-run effects. Often they don't replicate. And again, I think part of this is exactly what you're saying, Dan. They rely on these felicitous contexts, an environment that's going to support and nurture that initial push.
Right. So without using the word standard deviation, how big of an effect would you say this is? It's like 5%, you know?
Yeah. In percent terms, they're big, but that's because, you know, the rate of unexcused absences and suspensions is quite small. So in terms of an overall effect, we're talking about moving the unexcused absence rate in middle school from maybe 1.5% to 1.2%. That's like a 20% reduction. Now, Interestingly, as an aside, there's no effect on the excused absence rate. And that's one of the little kind of casual facts that makes us feel confident in what we're finding, that it's not an artifact of something else. It's focused on the unexcused absences where you'd expect it. And for chronic absenteeism, the overall effect is to move the rate from 8.3% to around 6.9%, and suspensions from 3% to 1.9%. But again, those overall effects mask the much larger gains that come from participating in the program over multiple summers.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Tom D. about the findings from a study he did on an innovative summer program in San Francisco. So what's your take on that, Tom?
I think it's hard to do meaningful things without money. So I'm sure the money matters, in part because of what it buys. But I also sensed in your question a deeper sort of query about the integration between summer learning programs and the conventional academic year. And I think that's part of what might make Aim High effective is they're in tight partnership with the school district and aligning their material with what kids are going to experience in school. But I think there are some deeper questions about should perhaps the school year just be a little longer, or should we rely on these kind of, you know, school district nonprofit partnerships? I don't think we have the kind of evidence to guide that right now, but I'm a dedicated empiricist. So, you know, I encourage people to pilot innovation and study carefully, and let's learn from that and figure out how to serve these kids better.
So I'm a parent, and I have a choice, Denise. I can send my child to some summer school. I can send my child to an enrichment summer camp. I can send my child to basketball camp where they're learning lots of things, but none of it will help them directly in school. Or I can have them stay home and learn to make their own activities for themselves. So which should I do?
That's a great question, Dan. I will be honest. I am happy if they just don't choose option one. Don't send your kid to a traditional summer school if you can avoid it, because we do know how kids react to that. It is seen as a punishment. It is seen as boring. It is a lot crammed into a small amount of time. You don't have necessarily the same teachers teaching in summer school as you do year round. So I think there's a lot to be gained from summer camp, enrichment camp, science camp, basketball camp, and also staying home and learning how to entertain yourself. If they're staying home, I don't want them on video games and TV all day long. Right.
Okay.
I think you've got to have somebody there pushing them out the door. So Tom, how would Tom answer that question?
No, I'm not going to let Tom answer that.
Oh, you're not.
No, I'm going to ask Tom just for a second. What do you think is the consequence of the pandemic on education, on when schools get back in? Right. There's been a period of online. It's going to be really choppy. Some kids, low kids with low economic abilities are going to get a worse deal. So what do you think?
Frankly, I'm deeply concerned. I mean, when we get more data, I'll be willing to have my mind changed. But my supposition right now is our kids are going to experience a learning loss, right? That is likely to be permanent, right? Like, as you pointed out earlier, Dan, we may be able to get them to remember what they knew before the pandemic quite quickly, but there still was a long sustained disruption to learning time. And that's going to put these kids on a different trajectory. And I think everything we know about the long-run consequences of skill development suggests that's going to redound to poorer economic outcomes over their entire lifetimes if left unremediated. So I would love to see us start having a conversation about a kind of Marshall Plan for American youth, where we think about strategies for reinvesting in them, remediating the harm they've experienced. And I think when we have that conversation, invariably, we're going to be talking about the summer just as we are now.
Right, right.
I played the cynic earlier. I'm going to play an optimist right now and say, Tom, that was a little bit of a scary thing for parents to hear. And I want to clarify that many kids were learning something during COVID-19. That teachers were doing Herculean efforts to try and get lessons to them, whether that was online or packets or whatnot. So I just want to clarify, you're talking about the kids who completely disengaged, who, like a third of the kids in LA Unified who were never heard from.
I think that's right. I mean, there's going to be plenty of variation in the degree of COVID learning slide. But I think as an overall phenomenon, it's likely to be real and something we should think about remediating. But certainly some kids are going to have less. And that, I mean, again, I don't want to be too dark, but it's going to create equity problems.
Before we wrap up, there is an optimistic point here, which is there are ways to make programs that kids really enjoy and they learn. And it just doesn't have to look like desk seat work.
All right. Thanks, team. Thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app and anywhere you listen to podcasts.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.